Welcome back to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. In the second hour of our show, co-host Rob Schmidt and I will continue our discussion with our guest in the studio, Russell Dellman. Russell studied Zen meditation, yoga, gestalt, psychology, and the Feldenkrais work, and became one of the first authorized to teach Feldenkrais professional trainings. He's the founder of the Embodied Life School and the mentorship program trainings that he offers internationally.
So before the break, I was starting to develop a thought, and now I'm going to resume something like that thought. And so the observation that arose for me was that we've had in some of our previous conversations on this show, and I'm in this particular case thinking of a conversation with John Wellwood, who is the originator of the term spiritual bypass. Right. And it seems to me that term expresses or means to express just this sort of narrowness of development in particular arenas of experience that you were pointing to, mm-hmm. and that your own embodied life mentorship program training is intended to address, as I understand you to say. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I'm happy to have a comment about that. Yeah. I also want to know what you mean, how you're using, and what you mean by the word mentorship. So that's actually two questions, and you can, if anything comes up for the first one, go for it, and if it's the second one, go for that.
Yeah, great. So let's start. I'm interested in both. So this spiritual bypassing, I think, is a very important current idea. Mm-hmm. Genlin's version of that he brought many years ago was process skipping.
Sort of like skipping on a record or something like that.
Right. It's like when you're in the process of your life and you're no longer integrating some facet, some relationship, some conversation, it kind of, you skip over it. But mm-hmm. it doesn't just go away. It kind of lingers somehow in your tissues or in some place.
Right.
So process skipping or spiritual bypassing is a really important idea. But I'd like to go a little deeper with it. Mm-hmm. Because as with all, in my experience, all ideas, there are many edges to them that are helpful and some that are not so helpful. So for many people who have, let's say, initial spiritual awakenings, there's a genuine recognition that my historical self is just a small part of me, that I am deeply connected to this cosmos, and that the I is much more than a man or a woman, a certain age, any of the characteristics of the I. You get to have an experience of that vastness. When someone has that experience, it's very easy to then try to move in their everyday life as if, oh, that's unimportant because I know I'm connected to all. It's one of the great dangers of some of the non-dual teachings that are out there, in my opinion.
I couldn't agree more.
So one of the things that happens is people have this incredible experience, but they're really in relationships or in their compassion for other people, in their connectedness, in their capacity to communicate, something gets really lost. And it's not that their experience wasn't genuine. It's that they're trying to use it as a dodge, as an escape. And so that's really a limitation on human development, in my opinion, because if anything that's left out that's part of ourselves means that you're not whole. So it's like if you rip out, if you were a 300-page book and you ripped out page 179 because you didn't like it, and you ripped out page 210 because there was a lot of pain, you're not getting the whole book, and so you're losing your wholeness.
Since we're in a radio station, I guess I think of this in terms of dynamic range. That if I'm understanding what you're saying, then to have the more sort of rarefied spiritual understanding or experience, also for that to be completely integrated, one should be completely comfortable to be operating at the most quote-unquote mundane levels of human interaction and just tasks of daily life.
Right. Yes. And but now I want to go to another side of it, which is there's a way in which many of us who are coming to spirituality from psychological backgrounds that we can in some ways reify our wounds. This is the other side of spiritual bypassing is wound worship.
That's I love that
that's
term.
That's the term I put, that I created
I,
for that.
I love it. I think I know exactly what you mean, but I want you to elaborate for our audience more.
So wound worship is as you learn to get in touch with what happened from your past, what your response patterns are, what your feelings and emotions tend to be, that in honoring them, we can tend to water the seeds of the same patterns. That honoring them and giving space for them and allowing ourselves to communicate about can actually grow, actually neurologically, grow the pathway so that they become even more entrenched and in the guise of becoming authentic and accepting of all parts of myself, we actually learn to worship some of the parts that are the least liberating, ultimately.
It's interesting because, I mean, at the sort of the course level, I think many of us have had experience of people who in the name of authenticity are actually doing a sort of a covert hostile act of, right. I think you're talking about something even subtler.
It's that also, but at a more subtle level that we actually begin to define ourselves in terms of our hurts.
Mm-hmm.
We begin to say, oh, I need to. And this is not somebody who's not aware of themselves. Somebody, you know, I really need to take care of that place in me. So, I can't interact. I can't really be available for X, Y, or Z because I need to go take care. Now that's a wonderful thing once in a while sometimes, but for some of us that becomes their modus operandi is taking care of the hurt and actually making them stronger and more important. It's like the wounded child mm-hmm. gets to take over the life. And all of a sudden, this image of a wounded child, which is a beautiful image when held lightly, becomes a thing. Oh, that's my child that I need to take care of. And it becomes a kind of way of sorting through life and not letting oneself go, okay, yes, that's a hurt place, and I can engage in this.
Thank you. I mean, one of the things that comes up for me with this is that it can also it's also a public act, usually, in the way that it manifests. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as a public act, precisely in the way that you were saying that our realization is only real when it is enacted in the world, in relationship in our relationship to the various parts of the world. This is the reason that what you're describing is a mistake. Not that it's bad, but it's just a mistake, is precisely because when it becomes this way of interacting, usually with people, then it forecloses so much possibility with other people because that's the only way they can interact with you in certain contexts.
I'm really glad you're emphasizing that, Rob. That's so, so right for me. It's in our relationships. You know, we wake up through our relationships. We express. You know, there's a difference between realization and actualization. And we can have realization experiences all over the place that don't actualize. Mm. Actualize is our connecting to other people, our enacting in the world. And it's that, and you mentioned bodhisattvas before. Well, that's where we see how is this person's inner practices manifesting. You know, I like to use this image lately in my seminars. I say, everyone's interested in climate change. And I said, I am too. I'm interested in CO2 emissions. But my deeper interest, when I think of my daughter going off to university, she's going to go into a graduate program, I'm interested in the climate of the people she's interacting with. Hmm. Because we each have a climate. We each are an atmosphere. And what is the atmosphere that we're bringing to each other? And that determines the climate of the world. So if we are in this place where we're kind of stuck in a limited self-identity, it's just as restricted as if we are stuck in this spiritual bypassing where we have this incredible experience, but we're still not in relationship because we don't want to have to feel certain things. Because we know it's not real in some absolute sense.
Got it.
Yeah? Yeah, so that is really the current, I think, spiritual issue for our times. And it's a very interesting integration of the archetypical masculine and feminine, is how do we bring our autonomous, individual, realized selves into relationship with each other in ways that are mutually supportive and ultimately life-giving.
Right.
Beautifully said. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, that then leads on to my second question of mentorship.
Oh, great. Thank you. Great. So that's actually a perfect segue.
Yeah, it is. I thought so, too.
So mentorship, my picture of
so
that.
So proud of myself.
My picture of mentorship was that I realized that I through somehow was blessed with personal relationships with a few. I knew Feldenkrais well. We were close. Jen Lin became a very good friend. I'd say one of my best friends. He still is one of my best friends in the world. And it's through the personal relationships that much of the learning deepened and became part of my entirety, I would say. What I find with my students is that it's not that we need a lot of interaction, not that we need to sit together for long periods, but that they know that I know something about their inner life, even about their story and their stories, mm-hmm. and their kids.
Sure.
That they know something about that, and that we can feel a resonance between each other, that our, what some neurologists like to think of as limbic resonance, that sense mm-hmm. that we feel each other.
Yeah.
Well, that is such a key part of deepening the learning, of entering what I mentioned before, that state of inner safety, where we can allow what's happening in our meditation or in our movement lesson or in our inquiry to really penetrate through more deeply. So I really believe, and the feedback I get from my students is that, you know, there's something about the personalness, mm-hmm. even though I've got hundreds and hundreds of students around that I have active relationship with around the world, that's a very important part for me and for my development. And I mean, at times it can be overwhelming. My wife will say, "You on your email again?" Because I have hundreds of people writing questions, sincere, deep, that if I don't stay up on that, it becomes really overwhelming. But for me, it's to light some incense and really sit with a student's question. They're writing from mm-hmm. Germany, and but they know that I know something, even though it's not that we're spending hours in private time together.
There's an analogy I can think of in my own experience of how we've had either phone conversations or Skype conversations with people related to our practice, and that these relationships, when we've been together face to face, there's something that's the present there that isn't present when it's just a relationship that never had that connection.
Really true. Our bodies, in my language, our bodies become resonant with each other, and that resonance then doesn't require physical proximity. It has at least a certain lifespan in which it's the cells know each other across right. time and space.
Right. I guess the physicists would say they're entangled at
yeah,
some level.
Something like that. You know, I would call it resonant. We can call it entangled.
Yeah.
but there is that, and that human connectedness is why mentorship to me implies that I am offering a relationship toward you. Some people come to me because they want to teach this work.
Mm-hmm.
Some people come to me, they have no intention of teaching it. They want to use it for their inner growth.
Mm-hmm.
Some people already have a related profession and they want to bring some of this into that.
Yes.
But the mentorship is not necessarily to mentor them to be something particular, but it's saying, I'm available to you. Let's see how this relationship can be in service to your what you're looking for.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the clarity of your response because this is something I've been thinking about over the last year. My academic mentor in that part of my life, retired a couple of years ago, and in November there was a session at the American Anthropological Association, and I and other students of her put together a session where we were talking about mentorship mm-hmm. in particular for this particular person, but it just led me to think about these issues, and mm-hmm. I found out that there's a huge literature on mentorship about, and often that literature is about the specific, it's about mentoring in specific ways.
Right.
What I very much resonated with and appreciated in what you said was this, the basic availability or presence of a relationship within which something can happen for both sides,
right.
but certainly for the students, it's like that may be something very, very important.
Yeah,
you know, crucially not present elsewhere in their lives.
Right, right. And I would say, Rob, I want to really underline that for so many of us, to have what's living in us met by another.
Yeah.
Not even that I have to do something brilliant with them. I'm not doing therapy. But the sense of presence for them in their entirety allows something within them to feel, through the process of being seen and heard, feels whole.
Yeah.
And it's part of filling a gap that's you know, I think it's recognized in the therapeutic world, but it's not, I want to separate it from the therapeutic world. I want to say, okay, that's nice there that, yes, your transference or whatever can be a positive filling in of a gap that wasn't there with your parents, but I don't want to surrender that to the therapy world. I want to say also part of our humanness to affirm each other. And there's a particular, exquisitely, vulnerable and precious and intimate role of a teacher to affirm that in a student. And especially, I function from a fairly new model, or not many models in my experience, of I'm not functioning from a guru relationship. I am willing to have authority in the relationship, and there's a sense of being on the path together, and that somehow my seeing of where someone is allows them to acknowledge it in themselves at a deeper level.
Totally.
And often, often that's seeing what's brilliant in them. It's not only seeing what they're spiritually bypassing or what's missing or like that, but it's actually being able to see, I see this individual with these habit patterns, and I see that light that is living in there, and I am committed to seeing that light, especially if you don't.
Well, see, thank you. The thing that's lovely and eloquent about, I mean, said eloquently, but there's something eloquent about that relationship in itself, it seems to me. Because if it's about relationship, if it's about a kind of conversation, whether with words or without words, then eloquent is an appropriate word for it.
Yes.
And that can be something, you know, there some people have made analyses of different kinds of relationships that exist in human societies. The reason I ask the question about mentorship is precisely because this teacher, mentor, whatever, you know, you're talking about it beautifully today, and we've talked about it with other folks on this program before, and it is something very important. It seems to me right now it's important to me personally.
Yeah.
It's important to how I interact with people.
Yeah.
Personally, it's important to understand how the models that we've inherited come out of hierarchical social situations that were enacted in the world in the past that may not be the only ways to do things.
Right.
And still there are things that someone who has opened herself or himself to see in herself or himself that can then be offered to someone else at a similar stage later on in life.
Yeah.
And that's a lovely thing. So I think this is just a very it's in the air, it seems to me.
I agree.
This sort of contemplation about what kind of relationships will actually make the world work better in the ways that you were talking about in terms of global warming and the environments of human society warming.
Yes. You know, it's so important to me right now that we know historically how to live in these hierarchical relationships. And then we know this more recent Western exquisite step of everything's equal. We're all in this together. Everyone's voice has equal weight. We want that also. But we don't want to throw out the value of, well, this person's got something to teach me.
Absolutely. how do we articulate that in this place that we're in, where we have this hierarchical past, where some of those wounds that we don't want to create bigger in the way that you were describing earlier, and nevertheless we don't want to pretend that they didn't exist either.
Right.
So this is it's an interesting historical moment for lots of people.
It's so exciting. It's such an exciting time to be alive.
Yeah, so I'm interested in a slight variation of this thing that we're describing, that you mentioned in your teaching methodology that you're not a guru.
Yes.
You don't present as a guru.
Right.
And I'm aware of some traditions as being, you know, having a teaching relationship that's fairly confrontative.
Mm-hmm.
Confrontative can be, you know, has its own spectrum of very rough to gentle, but still confrontative.
Right.
And then there's another modality that I've heard described as the spiritual friend.
Right.
And I'm interested in your observations and your experience on the utility of those different roles in terms of helping someone get past particularly difficult barriers. Because you said something earlier that kind of triggered this question for me, which was that Moshe Feldenkrais observed that if you don't create a safe space, then one tends to contract back to old patterns. And yet it's been my own experience in working with a teacher that sometimes a confrontative space, which was decidedly not safe to my mechanical personality structure, was a necessary force in order to shake loose a kind of identification I had.
Right.
So I'm interested in your...
Yeah, it's an interesting story because there's really subtle distinctions we need to make there. So is the relationship... Does the relationship have enough implicit safety that the confrontation, while being felt in the mechanical self or in the historical self that's got this pattern, that it can kind of loosen that without going deeper into the kind of substructures of self-protectiveness? So this is a subtle point,
right.
And I really, I err on the side of gentleness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not afraid of confrontation, but I see how easy it is to activate old wounds, or even create new ones. So in my Zen education, back in, I think, 1980 or something, I was living on the East Coast, and I went to a couple of intensive sitting periods called sesshins with a very strong Japanese master. And I was sitting, and my practice at this point is about 10 years old, and it was deepening, and I was bowing to him, which is something, prostrating, which is something you do in a formal interaction, a formal conversation. And as I was lowered my head to the floor, he took up his stick and started beating my shoulders. Now, from his point of view, he was trying to use this to kind of activate an awakening experience. He no doubt would say he saw me on the edge of something that he was going to... What's true is that for the next 30 years, every time I bowed in front of my regular teacher, who had no aggression like that, no violence like that in his teaching style, every time my head touched the floor, I thought of getting hit. I knew I wasn't going to, but my body had that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's so interesting, and I was able to work with that. It wasn't like it was stopping my practice. It was just very particular to that situation.
Right.
But it gave me a deep respect for the different levels that our bodies perceive at, and what can be helpful. Like, we can even have a helpful interaction where we become aware of something. Oh, it was really helpful that you were so strong with me. And sometimes that just turns out to be true. Sometimes there's unintended consequences of even a helpful teaching. I've noticed back some years ago when I was maybe a little bit more directly assertive in when I would see somebody's pattern, that I've had people come to me years later and talk about how helpful it was and wounding it was. So I'm not saying that that's always true. And there are skillful teachers who can bring forth what we could think of as a confrontational style that's in enough of a safe environment that it actually works. I would say for myself, is I am very willing to point towards gaps in people. I'm not just somebody who is going to just give positive. I want to be honest with people, but I'm so interested in the deep levels of safety within that nervous system, let alone the conscious mind of that person. I not only want them to be able to say, I feel safe with you, I want to be able to see it in the movement of their diaphragm, in the dilation of their eyes, and I want to see the physiological signs that this person is not in a fear response, given what I'm saying. Because those levels of learning have surprising impact, even when the conscious human being goes, it was really important for me to see my narcissism, and they really showed me that, and I got freer of it there, and I'm also interested in any unintended consequences that might come from that.
So I appreciate that. That's very clear. So then the follow-on question is that have you found that the gentle approach when there's a context of safety is such that you can have the same effect in pointing to something for someone to have a lasting utility from as a sort of the confrontative approach, whereas you use the example you cited, someone is confronted with their narcissism in a particular situation.
Yes. Okay, so as I want to answer from a deep place, which says, I don't know. And what I mean by that is, maybe another teacher could move somebody more quickly. Maybe my students are progressing more slowly than if I had another style. I can't really say. What I can say is I have seen deep transformation of what people would call very, very old and difficult patterns in my students. I've seen it in a way that I have confidence in it. I can't say it always happens. There might be certain people that it's a helpful style for, and certain I really can't effectively and totally honestly evaluate. Am I missing something with this type of person that a so-called hit over the head might be better? What I do find is there are certain personality styles that I will use more humor with, or I'll use more something shocking, but it won't be perceived as violent or yeah. So I have different styles, but I cannot honestly say that I know that this is effective for everybody.
Well, I appreciate that. That's very clear and very honest, and I appreciate that.
I'll just say that if most teachers would be that honest, then there would be a lot more effective teaching happening in the world.
Yeah.
Because if I mean, there have been plenty of people, you know, who have asserted, like Gurdjieff did, that there are different teachers in different contexts with different students have different results. Mm-hmm. The teaching is always changing, and the students are always changing, and et cetera. So, but I think that's a mature place, and I hear a lot of experience behind it.
Mm-hmm.
That clarity. Certainly, when I was very young, I just because some things were working so great for me, I just sort of assumed that it would work great for everybody. Right. I think that's a natural, it was a natural thing for me to project onto other people. Mm-hmm. And now, at a more mature place, you know, I can see that actually, it's very different for different people.
Yes. And I see, you know, one of the things I've been appreciating in the last 5-6 years, because it really is true. It's not simply a euphemism to say I'm as learning as much from my students as they're learning from me. Mm-hmm. Meaning, if, as Feldenkrais would say, and I would agree with this from a spiritual point of view, that the further developed you become, the better learner you should be, or you can be.
Mm-hmm.
So theoretically, if I'm in a room full of people, I should be the fastest learner, which means my development is accelerated by my interactions with my students, because I hopefully am less defensive. Less has to happen for me to see some new place that is has not been clear to me before. So what I notice in these last years is a greater diversity of styles within what I'm calling a basic caring or safety-oriented style, that with some I will really encourage. I have, for as an example, I do all-day sittings right here in Sebastopol 4 times a year seasonally. People can come and go as they like. They come for a half hour. They come all day. And so with some of my students, I say, you know, you can really, if it feels right, I really encourage you to push yourself a little bit more. You know you can do that 2 hours, but what about staying with me for half a day and seeing how, you know. So I do have ways in which I keep encouraging people to stretch their capacities. Mm-hmm. But I'm doing that, and I think this is a key point of my spiritual understanding, is everything needs to be done in freedom. That's such a fundamental principle of spiritual development, that if something is not done truly out of respect for that autonomous individual, that it will come back later, even if they have a breakthrough. It will come back later. That if mm-hmm. you can get that, if you can encourage as a teacher, as a spiritual friend, encourage, so, you know, I really see these gaps, and it would be, in my opinion, be really helpful for you to work with this. And then I leave it to them to do their work, and I'll support them in that. But that's, if they choose to take it up, then I say, then they're really ready for their next step. So that would be a way that I might push somebody, but it's a way of honoring them as an adult, autonomous, free being. Mm-hmm. Making use or not of what I'm seeing.
Got it.
And I think my final question on this, just to tie back to an observation you made about the embodied life training and the way of integrating the different threads of body, mind, and feeling. Mm. Do you find that the result for people who have transformations as a consequence of the embodied life practices has a greater staying power than, say, what you were observing of the Feldenkrais practitioners who would get on the bus and elbow their way to a good seat?
Really? Yes, that's absolutely true. And what I'll tell you, what thrills me the most lately is that I do these in many different countries. I do them, you know, in California is one country. I do them in California a couple times a year, but I do them in Germany, France, Switzerland. And what I notice is that as the program is growing, these communities are becoming self-sustaining. Mm. And that I just graduated a group a couple of days ago here in California. And one of the things that was so gratifying for me was that, unlike the early days where most of the comments would be, oh, Russell, you're such a great teacher, thank you so very much for all the transformational things you did for me, so many of their comments now are about learning from each other. And that feels to me like we've gone to another level that is needed for humanity today, this kind of interactive learning.
That's perfect. But we're getting very close to the end of our time, so we wanted to just make sure you had a couple minutes to, you know, let people know how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah.
We'll certainly put all this on the website when we post the podcast. But if there's any events coming up in the near future, let us know.
Thank you. Yeah, so anybody who's interested in what we've been talking about, I really encourage you to go to russelldelman.com. That's 2 L's in Russell and 1 L in Delman. Dot com, And I have a lot of articles. I have a video on there. I have upcoming seminars. I'll be giving a talk at Many Rivers Bookstore the end of April.
I think it's, forgetting the date.
27?
Something like that.
Yes, earlier.
It's anyway the last Thursday, I believe, in April.
And then I have an all-day sitting in Sebastopol that you can come and go April 27th. I'll have an all-day workshop, an embodied life work, June 1st. It's a Saturday. It'd be wonderful to come for the day, and we'll do a variety of these practices. But going to the website is the best way to get that information.
Perfect.
Excellent. Any other? We got a couple minutes here.
Well, I guess the problem is the question I have is probably hard to ask and answer in 2 minutes. But one of the articles that you mentioned on your website talks about technology, and we were having a little chat about technology as we drove to the studio today. And I'm just wondering if there's something that you could talk about very briefly about the embodied life and our modern technological world.
Yes, thank you. I would love to, really briefly. Right. You tell me when I have 20 seconds.
Okay. You got 90 seconds.
90 seconds, great. Well, what I want to say is I'm so grateful to technology that we can be talking like this. You know, I can't stand it when people are standing on their writing on their computers how horrible technology is. Yeah. So I bow to our scientific mind. I bow to our capacities. They can be used in life-giving ways, and we need to be really observant of how our brain has not had the time to learn how to use these technologies in life-giving ways very often. So we need to be aware of what we're doing with our kids in technology. I'm very concerned. I've worked with kids for 35 years, and the kids I'm seeing now are different than 20 years ago in terms of their attention spans, in terms of what they need to keep themselves calm in their body. We're changing quickly. And we need to know this. They're not ready to process that level of visual and auditory stimulation. We're overstimulating them and wondering why they need so much stimulation. It's like feeding them junk food all the time.
Got it.
Got it. Perfect.
That was beautiful.
Well, Russell Dellman, thank you so
much. And succinct.
Russell Dellman, thank you so much for joining us on the Mystical Positive.
Yes, thank you so much.
It's been a joy. Thank you.
Thank you. An hour and 45 minutes goes by fast when it's a good conversation. Thanks.
All right. We've been speaking this week in the studio with our guest, Russell Dellman. Russell is the founder of the Embodied Life School and the mentorship program trainings that he offers internationally. Next week, our guest by phone will be Lodro Rinzler. Lodro Rinzler is a practitioner and teacher in the Shambhala Tibetan Buddhist tradition and author of the recent book, The Buddha Walks Into a Bar, A Guide to Life in a New Generation. His Buddhist advice column, What Would Sid Do?, appears monthly in the Huffington Post and the Interdependence Project. Lodro began meditating as a child and sat retreats as a teenager. He's been executive director of the Boston Shambhala Center and has led numerous workshops at meditation centers and college campuses. And he's currently head of development for Shambhala internationally. He lives in New York City. So tune into that show next Saturday, April 7th, 2013. Upcoming on the spiritual calendar in Sonoma County, the Renewal of Presence Practice Group with the Tayu Meditation Center staff will be meeting on Tuesday, April 2nd at 7:30 p.m. at Many Rivers Books and Tea. That's 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. In 2 weeks, Nick Egan, a founder of Advaya Center and Nyingma lineage teacher and also sometimes co-host on The Mystical Positivist, will be meeting at Many Rivers on Wednesday, April 10th, from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. with his Opening to Insight meditation and discussion. This is a regular meditation and a discussion that's held twice a month, and he offers guided meditation practice and discussion, and it's for beginners and for people who are deep in their practice. Also, at this week and Thursday, April 4th, and the Thursdays at Many Rivers series is all All beings sing the song of Dharma. This is with Jisho Warner, Stone Creek Zen head teacher and founder. Again, that's Thursday, April 4th at 7:30 p.m. at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. The Dharma is a universal truth expressed in uncountable particular ways. We have deepenings to apprehend ourselves and underlying oneness of all things, and to find reliable common ground with the myriad buzzing beings. I'm sorry, the myriad buzzing beings with whom we share the earth. Zen teacher Jisho Warner of Stone Creek Zen Center in Grayton will present her ideas on this and engage in discussion. Jisho Warner is the head teacher at Stone Creek Zen Center and a contributor to the recent book Receiving the Marrow, Teachings on Dogen by Soto Zen Women Priests. Also, coming up in the next couple of weeks, our friend of the show, Lama Tsultram Alione, will be teaching in the Bay Area. She'll be offering a Chuh teaching on April 2nd through 4th. That's three evenings, 7:30 to 9 p.m., each evening at the Rudra Mandir Center in Berkeley, California. The cost is $100, a Chuh drum, bell, and Dorje required for this practice. For information and registration, contact Fran, F-R-A-N, dot Anderson, at comcast.net. And then Lama Tsultran Alione will be offering a Feeding Your Demons workshop on April 6th. That's all day at Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Woodacre. The cost there is $150 to $190 sliding scale, and add $5 at the door. For more information and details on this, go to spiritrock.org. Cows Community Radio is pleased to welcome and thank Valerie Adams as our new supporter. Valerie Adams is offering unique functional fused glass art pieces, gift items, interior design, accessories, and custom artwork at Modern Fused Glass. Valerie also offers hands-on instruction by group or individual classes. See her works online at valerieadamsglass.com. Valerie can be reached by phone at area code 707-539-4400. Zone Recording in Cotati has become Cal's latest underwriter, and we want to welcome and thank Blair Hardman. At Zone Recording in Cotati, Blair Hardman records everything. This includes songwriters, materials, bands, audiobooks, and voiceovers. If it's recordable, Zone Recording can and will do it for you. Visit Blair Hardman online at www.zonerecording.com. This is a reminder that Cal's Community Radio is membership supported. So we look for your support in the form of contributions to our Indiegogo campaign. Go to www.kows.fm to find out what you can donate, how you can donate, the proper links and everything to help keep this station on the air. Everyone involved in COWS is involved on a volunteer basis, but we'd still need your support to keep the station in operation. So become a member of the herd. Go to www.kows.fm and join the Indiegogo campaign. Let's see. All right. Well, thank you again for joining us for The Mystical Positivist. Podcasts of all our shows can be found at www.mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com, as well as commentary and discussions of topics of interest to the show. And send your comments and feedback to mysticalpositivist@gmail.com. Join us again next Saturday. Coming up next from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. is Ken Watts on Rockin' Record Hops, so stay tuned. Until then, we'll be listening to more selections from the CD called Attendo Heaven, Hymns of the Great Lent and Pascha, performed by the St. Seraphim Orthodox Choir of Santa Rosa. We will see you next week.